Hey everyone, thanks for coming. It is my great pleasure to introduce to you a friend and a former colleague from the Department of Homeland Security, Mr. Paul Rosenzweig, who's a graduate of the law school class of 1986. Mr. Rosenzweig clerked for the 11th Circuit after graduation and has had illustrious stints at the Heritage Foundation and other places, and is currently the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Policy and the Acting Assistant Secretary for International Affairs at the Department of Homeland Security.
Well, great. Well, thank you all very much. Thank you for inviting me today. I'm going to try and slide out over here. This is amazing. I was here 20 years ago. The rooms were a lot different back then. No technology at all, and much less comfortable seats, I think, for sure. You got the little Aryan ones with nice backs. I also had forgotten in the time I was away how cold it gets in Chicago. But I'm glad to see that some things don't change no matter what you do. I wanted to take some time today to talk to you about how we use information to try and identify terrorists and other bad actors who might pose a danger to the United States. And my main goal here is to bring first a little bit of reality to the law school environment, tell you a little bit about some of what we actually do and how it actually works and why it's a very effective tool, and then to come back to some of the theoretical problems and perils that lie behind this. And my thesis, broadly speaking, is that they're not the same perils that you hear about in the paper all the time. If you follow any of the discussions about this, there's a lot of discussions about privacy threats that come from information use like this. And there are real privacy threats, but they aren't the ones that most people talk about. And so that's kind of my broad overarching goal here, and then obviously want to leave a lot of time for questions at the end. So let me start by saying that this idea about preventing terrorists from coming to the United States is pretty much the core mission of the department. And what I want to talk about today is actually part of a transition that's not being noticed very much of the department from a purely defensive organization. Indeed, today, if you go and look up our strategic plan on the web, and you can get it because every government agency has a strategic plan, it's phrased almost exclusively in defensive terms, keeping bad people and bad things out of the United States, which reflects, I think, quite rightly how the department was conceived and what its intentions were in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. It had pretty much a be in a defensive, crouch, be reactive idea behind it. Now, today, we are transitioning into one that plays offense as well, one that participates actively in the disruption and frustration of terrorists and other criminal activity. And that's actually, I think, a transition that is occurring throughout the U.S. government. As I survey kind of American government actions against terrorism in the post 9/11 world, we see great successes in lots of the other domains of the government. Our colleagues in the Department of Treasury, for example, have made great strides in disrupting the flow of terrorist cash and money around the world. Money is, of course, the lifeblood of most terrorist operations. You all know this because you're at Chicago, where we understand markets and economies, and you can't do anything without money. No longer today does money flow unobserved. Electronic transfers of money are generally registered internationally now in ways that they were not 10 years ago, pre-9/11. And it allows the Treasury Department, working in concert with its international partners, to identify those flows. And we've clamped down on that pretty much. Similarly, we've seen significant successes throughout the federal government in clamping down on terrorist communications. Now, I'm not here to debate the NSA surveillance program, and frankly, I couldn't debate it because it's classified at a level I don't know much about, so I don't know very much more about it than I read in the papers, which kind of leaves me disabled from actually discussing it. But the one thing I can say from watching the other side of it is that terrorist communications are at a significantly greater risk right now than they were pre-9/11. The chances of interception of the use of those communications by the United States and, again, our international partners is much greater. So even though terrorists continue to develop innovative communications technologies and methodologies now, the most recent that's been publicly identified is the use of dead drop draft emails. So if you draft an email and leave it in your Gmail account, but don't send it, and then somebody else logs in and can read your draft email, and that's actually the message. That's pretty innovative, right? It's a way to avoid the transit of information across the internet. So they've got new innovative techniques, but nonetheless, they've had to transition quite a bit in how they communicate with one another. And what we see in the last 2-3 years as a result of those two major changes is a significant increase in personal travel of terrorists, both as messengers carrying information from one space to another space, and as bulk cash couriers carrying wads of cash in suitcases and things like that across international boundaries. Now, of course, we see increases in bulk cash couriers for other reasons as well. Drug couriers smuggle their drug proceeds. But in the terrorist domain, we see the use of personal travel as a significant alternative, and at least up until now, a much easier alternative. And so what we're trying to do today at DHS is target those terrorists who are traveling. We spend a lot of time doing it, but our goal essentially is to make travel, personal travel for terrorists and wrongdoers as difficult as we've already begun making the transmissions of cash and the transmissions of information in the communications network. Now, I mean, just to be clear, just reflect back on 9/11. When you think about international travel, it is, in fact, as the 9/11 Commission said, the lifeblood, the other lifeblood, travel and money of terrorist organizations. The 9/11 plot was hatched in Central Asia, recruited from Saudi Arabia, trained in Afghanistan, planned in Europe, and then executed in the United States, all of which required significant international travel. And at that time, terrorists traveled freely through the gaps in our system of identifying individuals who were traveling. So what we're trying to do now is change that system, come to a place where we can actually identify dangers and risks of people who are traveling across international boundaries. To do that, I'd like to start my talk with a story illustrating the power of what we're doing. It's the story of, and this is, by the way, I'm going to start by telling you all the good stuff. I promise I will get to the perils of data processing in the latter half of the talk. But all too often we talk about those perils, the threats to privacy and the possibilities of misuse, without actually understanding the positive values on the front end. So I want to lay the groundwork for that. This is the story of Raed Albania. Albania arrived in Chicago O'Hare in late 2003. And at that time, we were using just the beginnings of this system of analysis that I'm talking about here. Based on linked information in his profile, he was referred to what we call secondary screening. I don't know how many of you have experienced secondary screening, but when you're traveling, when you're arriving in the United States, primary screening is when you take your passport and you show it to a CBP officer, and he swipes it and he says, oh, where have you been? And you say, oh, I was in Great Britain. He says, oh, well, welcome home, and you go right on in, you collect your bags, and you leave. Secondary screening is when he doesn't say, well, welcome home. He says, would you please go over there and spend some time talking to these CBP officers about your trip. And you'll go there and they'll ask you more detailed questions about who you are and what you've done. Sometimes they will look through your bags, that sort of thing. In secondary, Mr. Albania was fingerprinted and then denied entry by an alert CBP officer. Now, I don't want to oversell this. To be honest, at the time, the officer was acting on a limited set of information and and the responses that he'd received from Albania that gave him an uncertainty as to the validity of what Albania was saying and his purposes in the United States. It wasn't cold hard fact. It wasn't the type of stuff that would let us arrest a person, right? Or deport him or anything like that. But it was instinct, if you will, plus a limited amount of information. On that basis, Albania was denied entry, and he was sent back to London from whence he'd originated. The next time we saw Albania's fingerprints, they were attached to his hands, which had been manacled to the steering wheel of a car that had blown up in a market in Hilaf, killing more than 125 people. Albania was celebrated by Al-Qaeda as a martyr for his sacrifice. Most of the dead were Iraqis, Iraqi civilians. Do we know what Albania intended to do in the United States on the day he arrived in Chicago? Absolutely not. No idea. Maybe he was coming to go to Disneyland. Probably not. And to the extent that there's an uncertainty about that, I, for one, think that the combination of limited information, uncertain information, and the CBP officer's instincts at the border did the right thing at this time. And I'm pretty glad that this guy didn't show up. He actually said, "I was shocked. That this was so close to home, I actually interviewed someone." You never know who you're interviewing or what they're capable of doing, which is kind of the uncertainty that we operate in at the border. You have a very limited amount of time. Now, Albania was targeted by something we call the Automated Targeting System, ATS. Everything in the U.S. government is an acronym. ATS is a rules-based targeting system that takes in a whole host of information streams and uses them to identify for the CBP officers who should be sent to secondary for additional screening. Now, I want to emphasize that point right up front. It isn't a system that says who should be arrested, right? Who should be shot on sight or anything like that. It's a system that says this person warrants more scrutiny, therefore allowing us to target our resources at people about whom we know enough to actually have some concerns. What are the information streams that come into this ATS system? Well, from the FBI, we get the National Criminal Information Center system. So the list of wants and warrants, people who are wanted for murder or something like that in the United States. From Interpol, we get international wants and warrants. We also get from Interpol lost and stolen passport information. So if a passport number shows up and it matches something that's been reported as lost and stolen, there's at least a reason to think that the person is traveling on a lost and stolen passport. And that's obviously often, though not always, a sign of nefarious intent. Sometimes it's just they lost it, they reported it lost, then they found it and they traveled. Right, but often it's they lost it or it was stolen, and somebody else has put a new photograph in and is trying to travel as if he were the other person. We get information from the Terrorist Screening Center. We have a watch list of the names of known terrorists or known suspected terrorists that we think we should pay attention to, and if the names match, you get pulled aside for secondary screening. But we also get information about individuals who are traveling that isn't that closely terrorist linked. It's the name and information off of their passport, their name, their passport number, the gender. And it's also something called PNR, passenger name record data. Passenger name record data, I think that's the next slide, yeah, is the commercial data that you give to the travel agents. That's what I want to say. To the travel agents, when you're leaving, it's your payment information, your contact phone number, what your travel agency is, your email address. Now, why is that information of relevance? Because the importance of this system is not so much identifying the known terrorists. I mean, that's relatively trivial, right? It's matching a known name to a known name. And there's some confusion, right? You've all heard the story about how Teddy Kennedy got stopped several times because he had the same name as a Theodore Kennedy, who was an IRA, a suspected IRA terrorist. So, yeah, okay, so there are problems with that. But that's a computer system that needs to be solved. That's not a theoretical problem. The theoretical problem is identifying the people you don't know. the unknown terrorists, what we in the intelligence business call the clean skins, because their name has never appeared on any watch list, and we've never identified them as a known or suspected terrorist. And this information allows us to identify them through what we call link analysis, right? If we have a phone number of a cell phone, for example, here in Afghanistan or Pakistan, that has been associated with terrorist activity in Pakistan, and the individual gives that phone number as his contact phone number upon trying to enter into the United States, that's something we should know about. That's something that's worthy of inquiry. To give you just one example that occurred in the last year, three folks from Iran were arriving in the United States. And they gave as their contact phone number a phone number that was the subject of a joint terrorism task force investigation here in the United States for money laundering that was sending money back out to the Iraqi militia in Iraq. Now, the joint terrorism task force hadn't made a case yet, so this isn't a case of proof of beyond a reasonable doubt that these people were in fact money launderers who were supplying money to the Iraqi militia who are fighting against the United States and against the Iraqi government in Iraq. It wasn't a clear-cut case like that. But if you have three people traveling here on passports from Iran who are giving as a contact number a joint terrorism task force identified possible contact point here in the United States, that's certainly something that would warrant secondary screening and questioning upon arrival in the United States. And again, the system pulls them out. Let me give you two examples of some of the successes that come, since PNR is often a problem, I just want to show you, this is what it really looks like. This is what gets entered into your computer. It's not the standard, there's no standard layout. So this is the data that comes in from, say, American Airlines. And we actually have to parse it using a computer system to put it into a form where it gets readable. The original always gets saved, of course, so you can go back to it. But this allows us to identify an email address at hotmail.com, that sort of thing. So we use this, and then this parse data gets matched up against known or suspected phone numbers or email addresses or credit card numbers or the things like that. Let me give you two kind of concrete examples, because this, besides Albania, because this all sounds kind of theoretical, right? You know, it's like, okay, they're throwing a bunch of information around and it all kind of comes together, and how does it actually work? And I certainly understand that. But so let me give you two more concrete examples before turning to the problems. Okay? One example involved a corrupt ticket agent who was working overseas down in the Caribbean. And the modus operandi there was that an innocent family, like me and my wife and our kids, would come check in, check three bags on our return from a vacation in, say, Jamaica, get our baggage claim checks and our tickets, and happily go to the gate. After we had left and had safely cleared customs and everything, the corrupt ticketing agent would take an extra bag from underneath the desk, loaded with, in this case, cocaine, right, and check it in under my name, right? Because I'm a perfectly innocent guy, generally not subject to any real problems, and if it's checked in under my name, it's less likely to be scrutinized because, of course, this system is designed to identify the safe guys as well and not subject me to additional scrutiny because it's a waste of time and resources. I'm an innocent American traveling with my wife and three kids. So add an extra bag. We fly home to Dulles in Washington. I go to the carousel. I pick up my three bags, right? I'm not looking for a fourth bag. And meanwhile, the ticket agent's confederate has been alerted. It's coming on this flight. It's the green one, right? He picks up the green one, and he leaves with it. Now, obviously, we can, though this was spotted in the context of a cocaine case, right? It could be biological material that's a threat. probably too small a suitcase for a nuke, but, you know, radiological material that could make a dirty bomb. Anything could be smuggled in this way. Any good or contraband ranging from Cuban cigars to radiological material. So now, once we twig to this, ATS has a rule that looks at whether or not all the bags were checked in at the same time, or if another bag comes in 10 minutes later, then that bag gets shunted for scrutiny. And that generally is a good thing, because generally there's not a good reason. Sometimes, of course, I forgot to check in a bag, I come back, but that's very rare, right? One last example that I will tell you about involved a very alert analyst who observed a pattern of travel in which a woman went out from the United States to the Dominican Republic and returned the next day. She went out alone, and she returned the next day with her three children. Right? Documents were in perfect order. There's absolutely nothing suspicious about that. You can think of any one of a million reasons why someone would do that. They went out and they were visiting grandma, and she went to pick them up and bring them home. Or dad went down with them and she's bringing them home because dad's going off on a business trip afterwards. You can think of a dozen legitimate reasons why that travel pattern would be a perfectly normal occurrence. But it's a little bit unusual, so the analyst asked, you know, geez, that's weird, I wonder if I can see that again. And he found this woman had done the exact same thing 8 times in the previous year, each time with different children. She was smuggling children into the United States for a sex trafficking ring. Young boys and girls from the Dominican Republic were being smuggled in, then more or less sold into sexual slavery here in the United States. And each time the documentation was perfect, the forgeries were very good. So the return, each individual return looks perfectly, perfectly plausible, independently. Concatenated together in a system like the automated targeting system, it looks much more suspicious. And then, of course, once you know what to look for, right, we found 8 other women in the ring who were doing the exact same thing and had been doing it for a couple of years. So that's the power of this kind of form of data analysis, right? That's the types of things that one can do. And, you know, when I describe that, most people seem to think that they're pretty comfortable with thinking about that as a good thing, right? I mean, most of these stories actually resonate pretty well. But there are perils to it, right? Now, the two that are most common that people talk about a lot are the ones that I don't think are the real problems. But let's talk about those first. The first one is false positives, right? I'm Teddy Kennedy, the good guy, not Teddy Kennedy, the bad guy. Right? I'm not the IRA terrorist, I'm the senator from the United States. That's an interesting one, but it doesn't apply in the international travel context with nearly the same amount of force. Because in the international travel context, every person doesn't have just a name. They also have a number, a passport number, right? That comes on their passport. And that serves, like a social security number, as a unique identifier. That will disambiguate you. There's one of those technical words that we had to make up. That will differentiate you from the other Teddy Kennedy, right? So in the international context, the false positive only happens once. You are the Teddy Kennedy who comes in, because we don't have the number usually for the bad guy who's in the terrorist screening center. He's just T. Kennedy or Teddy Kennedy. But the first time you come in as Teddy Kennedy, with a good U.S. passport, and you get identified as Teddy Kennedy, the U.S. senator, who now has passport number 12345678, then that name gets linked to that number, your passport number, and to an affirmative clearance that this is, in fact, the good Teddy Kennedy, not the bad Teddy Kennedy, right? So false positives do happen because our information about who the terrorists are is incomplete. It doesn't usually come with a passport number for the terrorist. Unfortunately, that would be, you know, that'd be something pretty good and effective, but it doesn't quite work that way. But the first time through, the link gets made to a legitimate number and a legitimate person, and then the differentiation is complete. The second principal complaint is that this data is personal data. Right? People say, well, you know, you've got my, we go back two slides, you got my phone number, my email, things like that. And that's true. It is personal data, right? I'm sorry about that, guys. That should have been turned off. Apologies. Does Langbein still teach here? No. When Langbein was here, if you were late, he'd lock you out. And wouldn't let you in. It was something. And we didn't have cell phones 21 years ago. But if something went off and there was a thing, he'd throw erasers at you. Of course, back then we had soft erasers, not the hard ones. But there you go. So I apologize for that. A true story is from the crypts of the University of Chicago, right? So where was I? Okay, personal data. It is personal data, right? But there's two things about that you should think about as you work your way through it. The first is, it's not really that personal, right? It's data that you've already given to the commercial airline, right? And that you can buy on Google for $100. I can get everybody's credit card number and phone number and email address. You know, with a very, you know, it's relatively easy. $100 a person. Not all of you for $100. But more importantly, the safeguards that we put in to the use of this are pretty stringent. It's things like auditing, so that we check whenever the database is queried to make sure that nobody is looking inappropriately for Britney Spears' home phone number, right? And nobody's querying on that to find out what it is. It's limitations on access. So it's only a small number of analysts who actually have access to this information. It's not like everybody, every Tom, Dick, and Harry in the world can just log in and gain access to all of it. It's retention policies that move this data into archives after a fixed period of time, so that it's not routinely available, but only available in the long term with high-level approvals. It's external oversights, internal and external oversights from both from our own IG, our Inspector General, and from the General Accounting Office, Government Accountability Office now, I guess they call themselves. So by and large, I mean, you know, I'm pleased to say we've been running this 3-4 years now, and in this system, unlike certain other governmental systems, I'm more than happy to admit, but in this system, there are no known abuses. I know you can't prove a negative, but there are no known abuses. That's hard. There are no known abuses. So, to my mind, the things that people say in public about this, the threats to privacy and all, are pretty much missing the mark. Let me talk about the perils that I see are the real perils. Going forward. The first is that the information doesn't have context. What we see as the information comes in is an arrest record, or a lost and stolen passport record, or a prior immigration violation. But it doesn't say what it was for, or more importantly, you know, what the resolution was and what the context for it was. So there's no difference between the arrest for marijuana possession that was, you know, a 17-year-old peccadillo that, you know, was the predecessor to 20 years of good life and clean living that never became another problem for an individual, and how it shows up if you're arrested for marijuana possession, but that's really the pleaded down felony for selling marijuana and cocaine to little kids in schools, right? Or something that would be far more nefarious and far less well thought of. So it's actually paradoxical, because what we need to disambiguate those two situations and make a better judgment about what to do with that information is not actually less information, but more information, right? I call it the annotated tale. We need to annotate the arrest and conviction records of people who are that get fed into the system, their prior arrivals. You know, we know that they are stopped for particularized violations of customs law and had to pay a duty, but we don't know if it's just a couple of guys trying to smuggle some Cuban cigars in from Mexico where they bought them, or if they're smuggling prohibited devices that are on the prescribed list for export and import controls. We just don't know which of those is which. I was kind of reminded of this because I saw in the Washington Post, you probably didn't get it here, a story the other day of a six-year-old boy, 6 years old, who was charged with sexual harassment because he hit a little girl on the playground on the butt, right? Let's leave aside how gross and overreaction that is. Let's just leave aside. That's now, in a world where data is permanently and pervasively available, that's a part of his permanent record, right? And it comes up as sexual harassment. And Lord knows there's a huge amount of difference between sexual harassment of that form and sexual harassment of a far more egregious form that would be sanctionable. And especially as the use of this information gets moved from where it is now in a very narrow and confined governmental space, again with a counterterrorism and a crime-to-crime mission, into the private sector where it'll be used to make employment decisions, right? Things like that. The lack of context will, if it's not changed and fixed over the long run, haunt this young boy for the next 60 years of his life, possibly. There are no laws that require context in information like this, certainly not that apply in the private sector. So that's one of them. The second one is, this one will appeal, I hope, to the law and economics crowd in the group. The pervasiveness of information actually is going to mean, as it goes forward, even in the government space, that there's a greater certainty of punishment. The model that I would think of, just as an analogy for this, is speeding cameras, right? Used to be, it was very rare to get caught speeding. You had to have the bad misfortune to go right by a cop who was sitting there eating his cruller, waiting for you to come by. Now, with the prevalence of speeding cameras, red light cameras, that sort of thing, the certainty of being caught speeding is going up. And one can easily envision a day down the road where it goes up much higher. Now, you all know, because you're at Chicago, that we set punishment here as kind of in the United States, as kind of a deterrence value, expected punishment. X number of years times percentage of likelihood of being caught equals the expected value. So if it's 30 years for rape and there's a 2% chance of getting caught, or 10% chance of getting caught, I made my math easier, that's an expected 3-year value to you. And so we set the punishment limitation, at least in part, to achieve the deterrence we think is appropriate, based upon our belief that we will only catch 10% of the rapists or something like that, right? As the information becomes available and we have the certainty of knowledge that comes with it in many instances, think of financial crimes and the pervasiveness of information in the financial markets now. That means that the deterrence metrics are going to have to be rethought, right? Because now the second item in that equation is no longer 10% likelihood of capture, but maybe 20% or 30% or maybe even 50% at some point in time. So that seems to me to suggest that we may want to think about what our maximum punishments are and bring them down to retain the same degree of deterrence value. Either that or consciously at least think about raising the deterrence value going forward and what those effects are on society. The other side of it is the more certain we are of being able to spot wrongdoing, the more I tend to think that we're going to have to re-evaluate what our concepts of wrongfulness are. What I think we've seen in the United States over the last 20 years is that all of the wrongfulness is moving kind of up the scale, where the little boy hitting the girl on the playground used to be something that the principal would deal with, at an administrative level, if you will, it became a civil lawsuit, right? And civil lawsuits are now becoming criminal lawsuits, and the punishments are ramping up. If we are more and more certain of our ability to actually punish people and identify when they have done something wrong, we might want to think about whether or not all the things we've identified as wrong are wrong in the context in which they occur. Wrongfulness as it goes forward, rather than sexual harassment by 6-year-old boys. Or to put it another way, if we can find everybody who's smuggling Cuban cigars into the United States, do we want to continue to think that smuggling Cuban cigars is a crime? Which it is, right? And then the punishments will go through the roof. And the last thing about this, which circles back to the system, this is the real question. Right now, the way the data is handled in the United States and throughout the world is wrong. Databases exist over here, right? And you throw questions at them. Do you have any Muhammad Attas? Right? And the answer comes back, no, I don't have any info on Muhammad Atta. Well, that's great. But information is dynamic. And if I'm over here and I'm worried about Muhammad Atta, I have to throw that question at the database every day. Right? And so I have to throw millions of questions at the database every day and repeat it over and over and over and over again, which is A, resource wasteful, but B, the grossest invasion of privacy around, because I have a list of people. It's not just Muhammad Atta, who's obviously bad, but do you have a Ted Kennedy? Yes, I do. Which one? No, that's not it. Do you have a Ted Kennedy? Which one? No, that's not it. Every day. We call this perpetual analytics or perpetual screening, because the only way to get information out of the database is to throw the same question at it all the time. What we are transitioning to, and it will take lots of years because it costs lots of money, both in hardware and software, is to make every query a new entry. So the question, do you have any Muhammad Attas, goes in there and sits as a question about Muhammad Atta, and it will wait as if it were information about Muhammad Atta, because it is. It's the information that somebody out here in the intelligence community is interested in Muhammad Atta. Right? And it will wait there in the database until, 6 months, a year from now, 2 years from now, the Muhammad Atta is affiliated with Al-Qaeda comes in the front door over here. And then those two will be linked. So we call this every query an entry and every entry a query, because it works the other way. When Muhammad Atta is, Muhammad Atta is part of Al-Qaeda comes in first, then that's a query. Is anybody out there interested in Muhammad Atta for some reason? Right? And so the two pieces, we have to transition our databases to a system where we no longer differentiate between data that is the data itself and the query about the data. The two are essentially identical, which is going to take a lot of time and energy. So these, in my judgment, are the real questions about pervasive databases that are out there. The idea that as we go forward, there is going to be available both to the federal government and, let's be honest, to not international actors, other governments, and the commercial sector, pervasive amounts of information about you that, if the databases are not structured right, are going to result in perpetually questions being asked about you or somebody who you might be confused with. And if they're not annotated, we'll come back with answers that will haunt you for quite some time. We see this in the ATS system that we've built already, where we don't have the capability yet to differentiate as much as we would like. And where, frankly, we're able to catch everybody from the terrorist to the Cuban smuggler. Cuban cigar smuggler, and I want to move to a system where we can actually, devalue that or degrade that from a crime to a, administrative fine or something like that, or maybe make it not wrong at all, and focus the energy and the resources on the child smuggler, the drug smuggler, or Raid Albania. With that, I think I'll end and open it up to questions. Thank you very much. Echa. Forgive me.
That's okay. I'm worried you're hiding the ball a little bit. Maybe it's because BTS uses fairly non-controversial sources of information. But, I mean, I think one of the main concerns, I mean, when you saw the sort of furor over Poindexter's, you know, total information awareness system,
mm-hmm.
and Congress got so upset that they pulled all the funding, is that some of these sort of, you know, information parsing analytic systems are using much more personal pieces of information. They're using, you know, personal financial information. They're using call register data. They're using whatever NSA programs we don't know about. And that's what makes people concerned, is that their threat assessment is based on information that they think is private.
That's a good point. And I'm not trying to hide the ball at all. In fact, to the contrary, I think that those who complain about these systems hide the ball by lumping them all together. I agree with you that there are likely to be proposals for some data fields, some things like TIA, that delve into highly personalized information, sexual orientation. I can't imagine, but you can imagine any number of bad choices that even well-meaning people might make. But the reaction to TIA is exactly the point, which is people look at that and say these types of systems should be completely shut down, that we shouldn't have anything in this nature going on at all because of the potentials for abuse. There are actually some, you know, who say that the shutdown law for TIA, though it didn't do so explicitly, implicitly shut down ATS. The system I'm describing. I mean, there's a you know how laws work in Congress. No money shall be expended for, right? And then there's an active clause after that. And there are some, when they learned about ATS, they said, no, you can't do that. We shut that down when we shut down TIA. I think, as a statutory matter, they're wrong. What the text that they wrote into the omnibus funding bill of 2003 didn't do it. But that's a textualist argument. The policy argument that is, I think, the wrong one, is to reason from the potential of abuse in TIA to a border security system like ATS and say that it, too, ought to be shut down. I would agree with you completely that the development of these systems requires a careful monitoring, both by Congress and by other outsiders, you know, ranging from the press to the ACLU, and that there are some lines that need to be drawn. I would also submit to you just, you know, that not everybody in the room is going to draw the lines the same place, and so that's one of those things that's going to obviously have to be worked out in the course of our democratic process, for good or for ill, and they'll make good or bad choices.
I mean, I guess I think that works perfectly as long as those institutions and oversights actually are able to look at the details of these programs and analyze them.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is that a lot of these are secret. They're private. They're not disclosed. This NSA program isn't disclosed to Congress, so it doesn't have the oversight. So they can't, or, you know, I don't want to get into a debate about whether they were informed or not. But
I don't either, because I don't know. But,
I mean, the problem is obviously when there is no other branch or there is no other entity able to.
Well, I think that is right, and one should be more suspicious. Even though I'm in the executive branch, I would agree with you that one should be more skeptical of executive branch programs that have limited oversight than one should be of this. This program, we show to the Europeans. They send a team of privacy experts over to check our homework every couple of years. It actually, to be honest with you, pisses me off. Because, you know, I don't go and check their homework. But as a condition of getting access to this data from the Europeans, and precisely because the European vector is probably the highest value one for inbound terrorism today, at least that's our general fear, we were willing to make some chagrining compromises over that. But I would agree with you completely. Yes, sir?
When you were talking about false positives and how you only get a false positive once, I have two questions about that. First is that I know there's an ACLU lawsuit now about repeat false positives that have been occurring specifically at the Canadian border. And I was wondering if you could comment on, you know, if you're aware of that lawsuit, why those repeat false positives would be occurring.
Okay. Hold the second one and let me answer that one, because I'm a man of little brain, like the bear, little brain. Canada's different. You know, up until January of this year, you could cross the border on an oral declaration. You didn't have to show any paper at all. So you could come in and say, I am Paul Rosenzweig, American citizen. No number, no nothing. So that freedom on the inbound to show up without any documentation at all is matched by a high likelihood that, okay, I'm Teddy Kennedy. Great. Sorry, I don't know which one you are. Come on over here. I don't know the facts of those particular allegations, but my strong suspicion is that that's at least a large fraction of the cause. The good news, good news, bad news, right? You're going to have to carry a driver's license now to cross the border. Bad news, that's the bad news. The good news is you'll be Teddy Kennedy, the good guy, from now on.
And the second question is, once you disregard somebody as, you know, this is Teddy Kennedy, the good guy, what if Teddy Kennedy, the good guy, turns out to be Teddy Kennedy, the bad guy?
Well, that actually gets exactly back to this point.
Okay.
I mean, the way it's built now is the wrong way. There's Teddy Kennedy, the good guy list, and you're kind of perpetually on the good guy list. And that's a hole. It's one we have to build, because otherwise we'll be stopping Teddy Kennedy for forever, and there are millions of Teddy Kennedys in the world. What we want to move to is a system where that database, the query, you know, we've got a new thing about a Teddy Kennedy, right, who is an Al-Qaeda plant or something like that, lets us look at all of the good guy Teddy Kennedys, the 50 of them, and say, is any of them him? You know, and requires a vetting. But then it's not perpetual. We're not asking about Teddy Kennedy every day, but only when a new piece of adverse information linked to that name comes in does it generate a request to validate. And, you know, that most of it will be automated. You know, this Teddy Kennedy's 23 and was born Belgium. That Teddy Kennedy's 75 and was born in Boston. Okay, that's easy. And there'll be two or three we have to talk to. But that's exactly the point. Boy, there's lots. You, sir? I promise I'll get to everybody, or as much as I can.
You mentioned that the department's trying to move from a defensive posture to more disruptive goals worldwide. What are some of the information sharing protocols or obstacles to potentially implementing PNR-type screening for flights that either originate or terminate in the United States?
That's a great question. The European Union has, some of the backstory here is we had this huge fight with the European Union over the privacy of this data that took about 3 years to work out, and we finally have reached a comfortable place where everybody's pretty happy with the privacy protections. Everybody had to give a little, but it worked out pretty well. The European Union is so taken with the success of this that they have proposed to their own council to develop their own system. Given the speed with which these things are built, I'm going to guess that's about 3 to 5 years away before they can actually turn it on. In my judgment, if I were around in 5 years, which I won't be, one of my recommendations would be that it should be a United States goal to use those two systems on essentially a shared services model, so that the European Union, nobody would land in London en route from Pakistan who we knew to be a problem, and vice versa. Nobody should land in San Francisco, having originated in Jakarta, who the European Union has as a possibility. Those are going to, require huge, huge negotiations. Yeah, year of detailed talks, because now we're not just talking about the data, but we're talking about sharing of the analytics, and that always gets into very touchy things. I am reasonably certain as well that the possibility for a more globalized system like this will regenerate a lot of privacy concerns, both amongst the American public and amongst the European public as well. So all of which will have to be worked through. But for my money, if appropriately cabined with privacy protections, it's a worthwhile goal. Yes, sir.
So aside from the kind of working out of the privacy issues that you talked about, you know, vis-a-vis the European Union, what's the, you know, other international context with them? I mean, I would think by this point, since this stuff hasn't been around for a huge amount of time, but at least for, you know, a number of years, and a lot of the Europeans have been doing other counterterrorism stuff for decades, there's some sense, I would think, of like almost a best practices, you know, so we can take ideas from them and they can, I mean, what's that look like? I mean, presumably we want to be closer to, you know, maybe the French or the British have good ideas. We wouldn't want to do anything like what the Russians might do with counterterrorism if they're not.
Yeah, they're not as bad as we are, they're worse at privacy protection. Yes, I think that's right. That's a good question, and that actually requires one to delve into the unusual nature of counterterrorism activity at the European in Europe. They have historically done it only at the member state level, not at the union level. The Lisbon Reform Treaty that has been proposed there and that is due to be voted on this year, and if adopted to come into effect on January 1st of next year, would actually take most of that activity and make it a European-wide level activity. But even so, they will continue to have the operational pieces of it happening at the member state level. So it's a very funky, it's kind of like the worst of both worlds of federalism, because it's got the federal government telling you what to do, but all of the activity being taken at the state level. So there's a natural tension of directives from Brussels and, you know, that are unfunded mandates. It's exactly like that. So, for example, the way that the European Union is actually thinking of building the PNR system, passenger name record ATS system, is not by, as you might expect, a European-wide one, but by having the big member states, England, France, Germany, Italy, Poland, build them and do them as shared services models for the states near them. So Poland would do Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, right? And then all those five would come up into a big European system. So it's three levels of technology. And anybody here who's an IT person has got to know, it's terrible, it's ugly, it's a kludge. But that's where they are. So that's the downside. On the upside of the European Union side, it's very interesting to me. We've had all these privacy things going back and forth, but in terms of their willingness to act on analytics, they're actually a lot more aggressive than we are. We put a lot of our effort in privacy protection into use limitations, into constraining purposes. You know, you collect it for counterterrorism, you can't use it to go after deadbeat dads. Before you use it, you have to get approval from a court, things like that. The Europeans, they have all of their protections, not all, but this is a gross generalization, but it's fairly true. Their protections are mostly at the intake system, right? They don't let the government collect as much. But once the government collects it, Johnny barred the door, you can go wherever you want to with it and do whatever you want. So it's a basically different mindset methodology. And you know, just to be clear, it's all a continuum, so I don't want to posit, you know, complete one way for us, complete the other way for them. Yes, sir?
Let's say we're not talking about Teddy Kennedy, the senator, but you know, Joseph Smith, the accountant, who's not so well known, his entry isn't going to cause quite the same fear and embarrassment.
Mm-hmm.
If he gets caught up in this by mistake, what's the, you know, the appeals process, the review process, to make sure he can get back into the country that he actually can go travel?
Well, break that down into two pieces, right? You know, at the instant that he arrives the first time, the appeals process is very much locally. There's a decision maker who's right there. And then there's a supervisor and things like that. I couldn't sit here and promise you that nobody will ever be wrongfully denied entry on an individual basis. There are 87 million air arrivals in the United States every year. So even if we're 99.99% accurate, that's still 8,700 mistakes. I think I did the math right. Yeah, so that's not happening. But let me take it out of there and just admit that any system is imperfect, and that if you insist upon a perfect system before you put one in place, we would do nothing. We would have no welfare system, we would have no medical system, we would have no cops with guns. So let me take that out and just say, systematically, what we do is we actually have a traveler redress something program, TRIP. It's TRIP, you know, traveler redress something program. I forget what the I is. In which, if you've been caught up in the mistake, you can submit additional identifying information and actually get a TRIP number. Now, it's a unique 20-digit number that only you know, that when input, unless you type it in wrong, which has happened, unfortunately, because of 20... that's the reality of the world, but it's a unique 20-digit number that will get you through the next time. I have to tell you that in the international context, because you already have a unique 12-digit number, which is your passport number, the lack of differentiation doesn't happen very often past the first time. In the domestic context, where you're flying through and TSA keeps pulling you over for secondary screening and wanding you, it happens much more frequently. We've got about 37,000 people who have gotten TRIP numbers in the last year and a half since we started doing this. They say it helps. We're going to actually do more with that. I mean, just, you know, a little off topic, but we're going to do more with that by actually taking the matching function in-house. Right now, the biggest reason that there are problems in domestic flights is because each of the 63 airlines does it independently. And if you got, I mean, well, there's 63 people in the room. There are various, you know, some of you are very thoughtful, and I dare say one or two of you might not be paying so much attention every day, and it's the same. The same is true with airlines. Same is true with airlines, and U.S. Air is well known for being horrible. But they don't have the money to invest in a computerized system, so it's a hand check. They're broke. They won't spend the money, and so it's a hand check. And you know, you're comparing two 20-digit numbers. Yeah, you know how often that'll mean. So that's my answer. Next year, we're going to actually all do it automated in-house, and it should get better. Yes, sir?
I want to talk about a concern that you did mention. Either something that's important or you didn't think was important, and see what your reaction is. But one of the things that was raised as a concern when Homeland Security was first initiated was the amount of overlap that it has with other intelligence agencies. Certainly, if you look at the history of the intelligence community, there's lots of education effort, lots of turf wars, wasted resources. And to the extent that you say Homeland Security is going on offense, that they're developing these complex systems, I'm sure the FBI would like to have a similar system. I'm sure the CIA or the NSA either contribute information to it or like to run the system. How do you prevent these turf wars from happening when the mission of Homeland Security is changing the way you described?
Well, that's a great question. That actually is almost a separate lecture, which is why it's not. I would have to say that by and large, the turf wars are exist and are real, but are relatively modest and are, at least in this domain, unavoidable. That's the nature of bureaucratic stovepipes. We've worked very, very hard to break those down. I think, frankly, it will take a generation, honestly, where people grow up in the CIA or the FBI or DHS from the start of their careers with a mission of cooperation. Right, the people who don't are the old guard who, you know, the FBI used to be like this with all of its data, and the CIA was equally like this with all of its data. And if you've been doing that for 20 years, even though the president has ordered it and Congress has ordered it and everybody said, you know, give your data, it's very, very hard to change. In this context, this particular context, the risk, I think, is less. And I think that's because one of the things that we've quite systematically come to understand is that there's actually a gap here, the kind of border agency gap. FBI really has almost no presence at the borders. You know, if there's a criminal arrest and it's an FBI thing, they're happy with it, or a DEA thing. But generally, the people at the border are Customs and Border Protection agents, ICE, Immigration Customs Enforcement agents, who are the law enforcement arm, the gun toters, right? And then at the other side, you know, there's the intel community and the military, and they're generally not present at our borders either. They're, as you might imagine, they're out in Afghanistan or in Iraq. So they, too, are very, very little present. So at least in this congeries of systems that I'm talking about, the identification of people who are arriving, the overlap is small, and it's really a gap filler. And there's tensions at the end, right, at either end, when we start talking about using intelligence data for targeting here. The intel community doesn't want to give up its phone numbers or, you know, data. And when we're talking about, you know, arresting at the other end, the FBI always wants to be present for the arrest so that they get the stat. But there's this very, very broad piece in between that isn't nearly as complicated as you might imagine. And, you know, to take it up to a higher level, there's lots of bad things that one can say about the reorganization of the government and the Department of Homeland Security in terms of inefficiencies. My own judgment after being there for 3 years is that probably the single thing that you can say the most good about is the integration of the border function. You know, Coast Guard, Border Patrol, Customs, Agriculture, now all, you know, sitting in the same room with a single set of computer systems, that's a step function increase in efficiency and an improvement in security. Not to mention, at an actual improvement in privacy, since there's no longer these conflicting, you know, things happening to people. Now, so it's, you get one answer from the government. You might not like it, but there's one place to go for an answer instead of four or six.
We probably have time for one more question.
Okay. Yes, sir. Sorry.
I have a question about how the new types of queries that you're proposing work, particularly, as you mentioned, it seems like the move, as you say, is rather than building databases with entries that are queried periodically by agents, you essentially have increasingly autonomous systems, right, that take queries and then constantly, you know, as new information is received, query that data from me. So my concern really is about the potential for neglect rather than the potential for abuse, and how you might propose to resolve that, particularly because you put in a query right in the system and then it constantly scans, but people change, people's agendas change, and it could be seen as an equally invasive privacy problem, if not more invasive, to have an autonomous system, right, that's starting to continually scan through data and issue queries long after the initial reason for that query has disappeared.
Well, that's actually a great question. There are probably three pieces to the answer. So just to assure you that I haven't not thought about it. The first one is you've got to automatically age things out, right? How quickly you age them out will depend, you know, will always be contextual. You know, for terrorism data, it might be longer than for criminal data. And frankly, it'll have to be tied to the fidelity of the data. The more certain the input on the front end, you know, the more highly graded the source, the longer we are comfortable with the query living on, right? An unconfirmed report from a source who's never spoken to the CIA before, and as to whom we have no credibility, needs to last much less than, you know, a corroborated report from two independent sources, both of whom have proven reliable in the past. Right. So there's got to be automatic aging. Second piece of this has got to be tethering, which is another one of those phrases that we've developed, which is that the query has to be tethered back to the original inquiry. So the originating source of the inquiry generally doesn't have a lot of interest in continuing to have bad data and bad queries going on. So if they get contrary information, it isn't that they don't realize that and wipe somebody out, right? If they find out 6 weeks later that the information about Teddy Kennedy is bad, CIA, FBI, whoever it is over here, they'll wipe it out because they're not... It's a waste of resources, it's a waste of function, they will. What's the problem is, it's not tethered to this new place over here. So wiping it out over here doesn't actually wipe it out in the query. So you've got to tether it so that when you change one piece of it somewhere, it changes everywhere that it's propagated to, which is, by the way, a really difficult technological problem because it gets everywhere. And I'm sorry, but I had a third piece and I forgot what the answer to what the third piece of the answer was going to be. But if you do automated aging, tethering, it'll come back to me as soon as I'm outside the room. I'm sorry, but there's a third technological piece to that. Thanks a lot, guys. I enjoyed coming.